And work for me was reflecting my ego and my pride, and I just wasn't ready for it. And, you know, I do jobs that are probably just as impactful today and a senior today leading, you know, one of the largest private family offices in New York and probably one of the largest Christian private family foundations in the country, doing both of those at the same time. And so, but what I'm doing now is completely different because I'm doing this. I'm ready to give this up tomorrow if I wanted to do that. I'm not hanging on to it. It doesn't describe who I am as a person. It's not my definition of who I am from a self-worth point of view. And I think about it from a very altruistic point of view. And most importantly, my wife loves me doing it as opposed to hating me doing it. That's a big difference, guys, as you probably know. You know, every time I leave, because on Monday through Wednesday, I'm in New York every week, and sometimes two or three times a year I'm in Asia. It used to be that every time I used to leave for work, Gail would resent that. And now she's very happy because she just sees this is what God has for me, and she sees a transformation in my life. So the question is just purely and simply, you know, a lot of it has to do with your own personal relationship with God and where you are in a sense of maturity. But God wants people everywhere. And I also am fairly strong that God probably wants, I mean, other than maybe pornography and some stuff like that, I think God wants people in every environment, right? I mean, you know, should Christians be in a brewery? I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. Should Christians be in the media world? MTV, I was a good friend of mine, was the marketing director of MTV. Now, I don't know if you guys watch MTV. I try not to. But I think we can probably say MTV has added to the coarseness of our society and this, that, and the other. And, you know, so a friend of mine was the head of marketing of MTV. And you can say, what's a Christian doing there? His answer to that was, well, you should have seen what we'd have done if I hadn't been there. So we don't really know, right? And if you're called there, we're salt and light. And so, you know, I just think we have to get out of our little kind of prissy Christian circles, and we've got to get out in the world, and we've got to impact the world for Jesus Christ. And that's tough. That's frontline work, and you're going to be persecuted. You're going to be pressed on. And actually, some of that persecution comes from the Christian world. Oh, what are you doing that for? Well, how do you do that? I mean, you know, I'm a hedge fund manager in Wall Street. I mean, I think if you put a list of things that the Christian community hates the most, I mean, I'm pretty high up there. So, but I do that proudly because I think investing is a very, I mean, if you look at the development of world economies, you know, which economies do well? They're the ones that have the rule of law, they have efficient capital markets, and they have good education systems. And so the importance of investing and good investing is really tremendous in God's plan. I mean, you know, if you look at money and gold, it's referred to in the Bible far more times than love, for example. So we have to deal with those kinds of things. And, you know, so we have to go where others don't go. I mean, you know, when we look at Jesus's, get back to, you know, Ian's answer, Jesus, when we go and look at Jesus in the Bible, you know, he's not spending time with the good guys, right? He's spending time with the sinners. We have to do the same, right? I mean, how else, you know, in the early, you know, we look at the world today and we say, oh, look where it's gone to and look at what people believe and, you know, it's so different than what God would want and this, that, and the other. Well, what happened? You know, in the early 20th century, the Christian community moved out of the cities. It was the Christian communities that largely pushed the development of the suburbs. Why? Because the cities were dirty and evil and hard and etc. We wanted to go to places that were nice where we could build our churches with nice church greens and we could have schools for our kids. I understand the motivation. But what we did is we left the places of power. And today, you know, where are the Christian cities that we have around, you know, Colorado Springs, Orlando, I mean, you know, Charlotte, I you know, some of the Greensboro, North Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, you know, where are the power places? In the real power places, it's New York, it's Boston, it's L.A., it's Washington, right? San Francisco. So we're not in the places of power anymore. What happens in the workplace? You know, we shrink and we hide away from the tough issues in the workplace, and we go, look how tough work is. I wouldn't want to go work there. Well, do any of us imagine that it's like that because none of us have been there for a period of time and we haven't influenced it? So a lot of this is self-inflicted wounds that we have to resolve again. We've got to get back to the city. We've got to get back to the places of power. We've got to get back to the places of influence. And we need to do that not in a sort of a bombastic, loud kind of way, Bible-thumping way. We just got to go back in there. We got to work well, and we got to earn our spurs, and we got to get the ability to have influence. Yeah, David.
That's a very complex question as far as seeking knowledge and whether or not Christians are inspired of that. I think there's a balance required both based on the requirements of the job and your own gifting, and whether or not you can have the discipline to engage in that balance and what you can contribute to both the corporation and the workplace.
Yeah.
And so I think it's something Christians should aspire to, but they make sure that it's not going to overwhelm them or that they can accomplish what God wants to accomplish.
I think that's very right. And I would argue, again, from my own example and some others that I know, I think it's very easy to get seduced into the chase for the CEO-ship without having gone through that kind of self-reflection and introspection. And I think sometimes we get ahead of our supply lines in that. But that doesn't mean that the right person or the right Christian shouldn't be in those kinds of roles. I agree with that. Yeah.
So just looking at the combat situation, so if you just hypothetically can imagine yourself in a country that didn't offer opportunities, and you were, say, raised in a poor family, a poor country, no real opportunities, what would your view of work be, and how would you carry out?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a theology of work, it has to be relevant for all people, all places, and all times.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things I found very interesting is I had an opportunity in Korea to speak to a church called Global Sarang, which basically deals with Chinese-Korean immigrants. And in Korea, Chinese-Korean immigrants mostly are undocumented. They're used mostly to build roads and to be servants and this, that, and the other. This was a church that specialized in those. It had all kinds of services for legal services. It had a clinic and all kinds of things to help these kinds of folks. And I was invited to speak about work in front of all these folks. And I had exactly the kind of, oh, yikes, you know, is what I'm talking about the white-collar American experience, or what am I going to say to somebody who's essentially a slave with no legal standing in a country like Korea? And it was one of probably the most challenging moments that I've ever had. And what I preached on was Jeremiah 29. And the interesting thing that came out of Jeremiah 29 is, if you remember, this is the captivity, right? This is God speaking to the captives. And most people jump to 29:11. I have a plan for you, but I want to go earlier than that. I want to go through 4 through 7. And this is God speaking. And what he basically says is, you know, live a normal life. Build houses, you know, plant stuff, do things. And then he said, pray for the prosperity of the people. Right? So here we are, right? I'm captive by these guys. I mean, they've killed most of my family, let's say. I'm enslaved by them. I have to work for them. And God's kind of telling me, try and have a normal life. And by the way, pray for the prosperity of these people. Because if you pray for the prosperity of these people, then some of that may then fall onto you. And that's what I preach to those folks, and I ask them to pray for the prosperity of the people that they work for, and for forgiveness for the people that they work for, with the expectation that down the road, God would reward them in some kind of way. And I got fascinating conversations afterwards with people in terms of the way they had to think differently about their work. They had to serve people. They had to turn hostility and hatred into more of a servant attitude. And interestingly enough, most of these folks are sending money back to families, which is a result of what they're doing. They're living substantially better than they otherwise would do. So they're actually getting prosperity themselves out of their hardship. And so it's a whole kind of time frame issue that you have to think through. But I think the principles I'm talking about are as relevant to anybody. I call it the seamstress in Manila and the CEO in New York. Now, what the Bible does is it gives you instructions. When we first started doing the Theology of Work project, what we hoped to do was be prescriptive, to say, this is what the Bible says, therefore this is what you should do. And what it became very apparent very quickly is we couldn't be prescriptive. All we could do was ask the questions. The Bible is saying this. What does this mean for you in this circumstance? And to everybody in different circumstances, it means different things.
Yes.
For some people, it's an issue of survival and forgiveness. For some people, it's an issue of using influence. I mean, it's all different kinds of things. But there are normative principles in the Bible that we have to remember, we have to understand, and then we have to apply to our own circumstances. So even as we read the Bible together in this room and we would read the same passages, the Holy Spirit will speak to each of us differently. We're all in different places. We have different opportunities, and the work is exactly the same way.
I mean, if you think of giftings, passion, I mean, the third one, but just those two, for somebody who is in a situation like I was describing, how do you do that?
Well, giftings, you know, giftings can be used exactly. I mean, you probably don't have the freedom to choose among and between a whole variety of things. I mean, one of the problems with our young people today, I'm finding, is they've got too many choices. You know, it's just, it's a real problem for many of them. I mean, you know, when I came out of college back in England in the 70s, early 70s, you know, I mean, I had one or two choices to go to, right? I didn't have a wide variety of choices. I think you'll find that people have a narrow range of choices. When the poorer you are, the fewer choices you have. But even within those choices, and then once in those, you have some choice, and even within those choices, you have an opportunity then to demonstrate your value based on your gifting. And over time, don't forget, careers are 40, 50 years long. You have an ability to have a trajectory based on those giftings, which are different than other people. You know, people who are good laborers can become better craftsmen. Craftsmen might be able to become supervisors. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that can happen over a period of time. So, yeah, I mean, everything's different. The circumstances are different, but I think the principles remain the same. But I think there's an unfairness to the world that some people clearly won't be able to exercise all those things. One of the things we all have to think about is how do we help eradicate those unfairnesses? And I think that's one of the wake-up things for the Christian church in America is how do we become more... You know, I mean, let me just throw one thing out, for example, which is we like to go on our mission trips. The reality is when we go on a one-week mission trip somewhere, we actually put the people that we go to mission, I mean, to help, we put them out farm. I mean, they've been preparing for you for the months before. They hardly survive when you're there, and they have to recover when you've left. And we're there to help them. And we don't think about that. Right? We don't think about that. So we need to think about these things differently. And, you know, so that's one of the reasons I think it's very important to build long-term relationships with people where you keep going back to the same place. And then people can bring the gifts and skills that they have. So, for example, you know, I mean, I go on mission trips and I used to paint. And Ian knows I'm a terrible painter. That's probably not a good use of my gifts and skills, right? But if I could sit with some people who are starting some businesses and thinking about things, and I could sit and talk to them and help, that's how I started in Africa. I just sat with people and talked about how I can help them. So I think when people, but other people can do skilled work that I can't do, right? And so if Steve was to go over there, right, he could immediately tie into his skill set and begin to work with folks. And people who are electricians, people who are whatever it might be, could do that. So I think there's a longevity that we need to think about. But I think I'm getting a little bit off the topic. So, Rob, I'm going to hold because I want to, we're 3 out of 10 into it, and it's 10:15. Gotta go faster. So now I want to actually move on to how we should work. We've done the why. Now, and hopefully I've given you a big vision. And so let's work a little quicker through how we should work. And there's a couple of things I want to put here. Number 4 says quality, character, and ethics are foundational for our work. I mean, I hope we all understand this. This is probably one of the most obvious points I'm going to make, is we have to work with excellence. You know, when I ask people, give me a work verse, Colossians 3:23 is probably the most often quoted work verse back to me, right? Work with excellence as if for the Lord. And so, you know, excellence is clearly a hallmark, I think, of the Christian life. Interestingly, I have to say this. Many Christians are not marked by excellence in the workplace. I had an opportunity to speak to a CEO of a very large Christian organization, a Fortune 500 organization that is explicitly Christian, or was. It's been sold off and everything by now. And I said to him, I said, Bill, it has to be wonderful working in a Christian organization where everybody's Christian. He said, I would prefer to work in a secular organization. I said, why? He said, everybody comes with an attitude of entitlement, and we just don't do great work. That, to me, is an indictment. You know, if we're thinking more about how we're going to thump our Bible over lunchtime than making sure that we get our report done by 11 o'clock, you know, that's something we have to think about. And we have to compete, right? I mean, well, competition, that's sort of not really, really, no, I don't think so. I think, you know, we're called to do work. We're getting paid to do work. We ought to do that work well and with excellence. And that's the first place we start, because if you don't do that, then you have no right to speak to anybody about anything else. You know, 1 Peter 3:15 talks about giving an answer for the hope that lies within. Well, why would someone want to come to you to talk about that if you're a lousy worker? I mean, you do not honor the name of Jesus. The flip side is, if you do great work and nobody knows that Jesus is your Lord and Savior, you're dishonoring God as well. We have to find that balance. We have to find that balance. So there's lots of easy ways to do that. So, you know, I want to come back to the parable of the talents. Because I think God actually has a different evaluation process than the world. So if you go to the parable of the talents, you remember, you know, what the landlord said, well done, good and faithful. That was his response to having done well. Why does he say well done, good and faithful? Why does he use three phrases? Why doesn't he just say, great job? I mean, that's how we get measured in the secular world, right? Did you do the job that you said you'd do? Did you sell what you said you'd do? Did you deliver the numbers on time? Did you get a product out on time? Et cetera, et cetera. It's all about output, right? It's all about results. And that's how we get measured. Did you make the results you were supposed to? And yet here in this particular parable, we hear three things. We hear well done, good, and faithful. And I would argue that well done, and in the interest of time, I'm going to start to move a little more quickly, but I would argue that well done is in fact the process. It's the output. Did you do what you said you'd do? But then I think God goes on to two further forms of evaluation, which we need to think of as Christians. Good and faithful. And I think good reflects character and the person. And I think faithful means the process that you've taken. In other words, you got the results you wanted, but you beat some people up to get there, and you cut corners, and you paid someone off to get to that place. You may be good. I mean, you may be well done, but you're not good and you're not faithful. The world would say, fine. God doesn't say fine. So as Christians in the workplace, we have, and not just in the workplace, in life, I think we have a three-part evaluation process that we need to think about. Now, it's very interesting in the world of knowledge workers, and I love Peter Drucker. I don't know how many of you know Peter Drucker, but I highly recommend Peter Drucker to you all. You know, he was a man, a Christian, way ahead of his time. He did a lot of work. He's dead now, but he did a lot of work on knowledge workers. And today, so much of the world of work is knowledge workers. And I was just talking to David about, you know, if someone's sitting behind a computer every day, how do you know what they're doing? How do you know how productive they're being? How do you know how good their work is? Right? I mean, in the old days, if someone was a bricklayer, you know, you'd come up at the end of every day, you'd look, you'd say, okay, they've done five courses, it's straight, the mortar's even, you know, here's a piece of work and I'll pay you for that. I mean, it's immediate, the feedback. Now, there are some jobs where you get that immediate feedback. Selling would be one of them, right? But knowledge workers generally don't get that kind of feedback. You don't know how much you're doing, and your employer doesn't know how much you're doing. And it's interesting, Peter Drucker has basically focused on a thing that he calls contribution, that knowledge workers must be focusing on what contribution they're making and thinking about the contribution. And he marks the contribution in three ways: output, reinforcing the culture, and developing people. And I think that's an interesting kind of way that you can parallel that, I think, to this to this parallel. Output, which is, you know, well done. The developing people is kind of the good and the character, and the process is really the development of the culture, because the culture is the thing that drives the kind of process that you're going to have. And so I think this modern management science reflects this three-part bottom line that God has introduced. So when we think about excellence and we think about working with integrity, I want to encourage you to have that three-part evaluation for your own life. To think about contribution from those three ways. Did I do the output? was my character reflective, and did I help grow people? And thirdly, have I reinforced the culture? And the way I did it, is it appropriate? And would God be pleased? Well, not would God be pleased. Is God pleased? Because, I mean, we always think about, well, maybe one day God will look at what I'm doing. No, God is watching everything we do all of the time. It's kind of a scary thought. So I want to bring God much more into the present and the here. God is watching me speak as I speak this morning. And so I'm praying that he thinks it's well done, good and faithful. So that's where the judgment comes in. We were talking about judgment. Somebody, David, did you talk about earlier with David? Rewards, okay. Yeah. And some of the comments you see here is the rewards. So for example, Jeremiah 17:10 or Matthew 16:27 or even Revelation 22:12, they really speak about the kind of rewards you get. So there is this whole integrity, character and ethics foundational to our work. And you know, there should be no compromise on this issue. And what I would say to you is this: you have to make that decision ahead of time that there will be no compromise.
That's right.
Because if you get into a situation where you have a difficult ethical situation, let me tell you, you will find a way to justify a decision that's not right. It's called situational ethics. It happens all the time. And the impact on your organization can be enormous. I had an example in London when we were growing many years ago. This was about 1986. We were rolling out our new product. We sent our best sales guy to London. After about 3 or 4 months there, I got a call from our head of international. He said, "We got a problem, but I solved it. I just wanted to let you know." I said, "Okay." Always like to hear they'd solved it. He said, "We found out that we sent Peter over there. He didn't think we were paying him enough, so he started padding his expenses. We figured out, you know, he admitted to padding it to $3,000. He's agreed to a 10% interest rate. He's paid it back. We're all good," and this, that, and the other. And I said, "No, we're not. Because we had a, you know, policy. That's stealing. I mean, let's call it what it is. He's stealing from the company. You know, was he sorry because he did it or got caught?" I mean, the old argument you have with you. 5-year-old child, or your 10-year-old, or your 15, or your 25-year-old child. But so I said, no, you know, and ultimately we let him go, even though we were told, well, we're not going to make our numbers, you know, this, that, and the other. If I was there and we didn't have that policy ahead of time, you know, I could easily get into this justifying, well, you're right, we won't make our numbers, and he has paid it back, and he did pay with interest. Maybe if we actually put a punitive interest rate on it, maybe it's even better. Okay, what alternative, you know, you can see that line of argument, right? And I just said no. And my management team thought I was crazy, but I said, you know, we just got to do this. Anyway, we let him go. We helped him get another job. I think he really learned. I think he was really repentant. And we helped him get another job, and he did well. But he was out of our organization. We actually made our numbers, but that was purely by the blessing of God. But I can't tell you over the next 10 years as I went around my organization how many times people mentioned that instance as the time that they said, "We knew you were serious about what you were teaching and what you were having for it. We knew that was that you weren't just putting it on the wall. It wasn't just paper. You were actually going to live it." And what they said to me is, at that point, you enabled all of us to do the right thing. Because if the boss is doing the right thing, everybody can do the right thing. But if the boss is not doing the right thing, then nobody's going to do the right thing. So this ethics and this culture, so very, very important. Culture was, people was one of the key issues I focused on as I became a Christian. The other was setting culture. Because as I read the Bible, in particular Deuteronomy and Leviticus, not everybody's favorite book, but one of my favorite books. Because what's happening, and 85% of it is God speaking directly about mold on the wall, or, you know, if you've got a little pimple and you've got a white hair, I mean, this is God speaking. He's not sending somebody to give some sort of ideas, right? I mean, it's God speaking to his people about all these things. What he's doing is he's creating a culture. He's taking a nomadic people and he's setting rules in place whereby people can live with each other. He's creating the culture. And if God could create the culture as one of the first things he did, then I can create the culture. Every organization has a culture. Most of them are accidental. It just happens to be the way we've worked. And it may or may not be the way you want it. If you're a leader of an organization, your responsibility is to set the culture, set the tone, set the value system, set the ethics in place. and then you'll have a place where people want to come to work. I've never been to a place, I've never talked to one person who's ever said, I want to go to a company whose key values are cheating, stealing, and lying. Nobody. Everybody wants to have an ethical world, but you have got to give them the right to be able to do that. And by the way, that's not a CEO thing. It is a CEO thing, but it's not exclusively a CEO thing. You can do that at every level within the company. At every level of work group within the company, you set rules about how you work with each other, what's good, what's bad, and how you operate. So, quality, character, and ethics. Our work, and by the way, just one thing to finish on that is, often when people get tied up in doing the wrong thing, it's because they're trying to achieve an outcome. And one of the things I want to encourage you to do is we need to be responsible for the process and we leave the outcome to God. That puts a lot of stress on us when we're trying to achieve an outcome. Because Machiavelli comes into play here, right? The end justifies the means. All of a sudden, if you're trying to achieve an outcome, the process comes under pressure. So these are all the things you should think about around those kinds of things. Our work is yoked with Christ. We should work as if yoked to Jesus. I mean, this may be a slightly fancier way of saying, what would Jesus do? But there's a couple of things I want to say. You know, 2 Corinthians and Matthew 11 talk about being yoked. 2 Corinthians talks about not being unequally yoked with a non-believer. Matthew 11 talks about my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Yoking, again, is something that in New Testament times, people would immediately understand what it is. We don't see yoking much anymore. But a yoke is a heavy wooden instrument or heavy wooden thing that's shaped that goes across the back of two oxen or whatever it might be to pull the car. And they're locked in then by a metal clasp or whatever so that these two oxen are locked together. You can't go independently. If one goes left, the other one has to go left. If they go straight, they both go straight. You're to be yoked is to be in lockstep with that person. And God calls us to be yoked with him. And so one of the things I want to encourage you to do is when you go into the workplace to think about how I can be, you know, how do I influence the workplace to be yoked with Christ? Okay, so what does that mean? I think what that means is we have to know who Jesus is. We have to know his character. We have to know, if I'm going to be yoked to him, I have to have a pretty good sense in this circumstance, what would Jesus do? Because that's what he's encouraging me to do. Because we're his ambassadors, right? We're his representatives right there. And so, again, an encouragement to be back in scriptures to understand the nature of God and the nature of Jesus so that it becomes almost muscle memory for us. And the Holy Spirit will also guide us in that fact. And one of the places I found very useful is you'll see down underneath the passages I've quoted is Psalm 89:14. I'm sure nobody can quote that for me, but Psalm 89 is this fantastic psalm that describes, the first part of which describes who God is in its just most magnificent way. And by the time you get to 89:14, it says, and the pillars of his foundation are righteousness and justice, and loving kindness and faithfulness go before him. Okay, so here's the King of Kings, describing to us what the foundation of his throne is. You know, we spend a lot of time, you know, with George Bush, with Barack Obama, with Trump, trying to think about who are these people? You know, what do they really stand for, right? Every time we have an election, we're trying to figure out who these people are. And yet here is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords declaring to us who he is as a king. He has his throne. What are the pillars of that throne? What does his throne stand upon? Righteousness and justice. And actually, if you do a study, it's all in the Old Testament, none in the New Testament. If you do a study of righteousness and justice or right and just or any combination of those words, you'll find it many times. Like 25 times or something like that. But, you know, the joys of having computer Bibles these days, you can do these kinds of searches. It's nearly always to do with leadership. And it's mostly to do with David. So when God thinks about leadership by being a king, and when he uses those terms throughout the Bible as he talks to men in positions of leadership, righteousness and justice are the things that basically come forward. So if this is what God puts his leadership platform on, then what I say is that's what I'm going to put my leadership platform on. Righteousness and justice. And loving kindness and faithfulness go alongside it. What does it mean to be right and just? You know, right is doing what's right. It's that there are wrong things and there are right things. And we just need to make sure all the time we do the right thing. Justice is fairness. You know, one of the things that rips apart workplaces is unfairness and lack of trust. Why did that person get the promotion? Why didn't I get the promotion? Why did that person get more money than I did? Why did that person take credit for what I just did? Why is that person favored over me? What? You know, on and on and on. Why did that person go on that trip with the boss? Why didn't I go on? You know? Now, a lot of it is sort of self-centered self-pity, but a lot of it is just injustice. There's a lot of injustice in the workplace. There's a lot of unfairness. There's a lot of favoritism. There's a lot of not who, what you've done, but who you know, and this, that, and the other. And nothing tears apart an organization more than that lack of justice. When I can't trust my company, when I can't trust my leadership, it just undermines your entire approach to the organization and your desire to invest yourself in the company. So for me, these two things of righteousness and justice just become so critical to the way I think about doing my business. And I have to think about how to do that. And often I think about short-term negatives in terms of short-term give-ups versus long-term gains. You have got to take the long-term view in the world of work. If you're just talking short-term issues, you're going to be doing all the wrong things because you've lost the plot. You've got to be thinking about long-term. You know, the studies done from Harvard Business that do talk about, it's remarkably little actually, but it does talk about the superior returns of companies in which these kinds of things are more apparent than others. It's not as much as I would like it. You know, I'd love to these companies to be doing 20% better than everybody else, right? The number is more like 2 to 3%. Now, you can make a business out of a 2 to 3% difference, but it's not as great as I would want it to be. But there is a positive correlation between having these kinds of virtues in a company and performance. And I want to say that generally, frankly, about work. Particularly in today's world where knowledge workers are predominant. The Christian, too many times people say, well, I'm disadvantaged as a Christian because I'm not going to do in my work what everybody else does, so they're going to get ahead of me. I totally reject that. Because in a world of knowledge working, where it's essentially human beings who come through the door and provide all the value, Christians who have an appropriate view of people and an other-centric view of people who work with you should be systematically advantaged. Why do I say that? Because of a lot of things I've been saying already this morning. You create a culture that is healthy and allows people to grow. You select people based on their gifting and skills, and you place them in jobs where those gifts and skills are appropriate. You work with justice and fairness and righteousness so that people feel they can engage with their organizations and they don't feel disenfranchised. I mean, people then stay because it's a place they want to work at. The longer people are there, on average, the better they'll do. Turnover is a disaster in a intellectual property world. You know, these are things you can put in place, and I think Christians who can lead that way can be systematically benefited, and we can actually win. That's a competitive advantage we have as Christians by understanding human nature. I don't want us to get sort of, oh, I can't do those bad things and therefore they're going to... No, let's focus. You remember I've talked about the person with the A's and the B and C? Let's not focus on the B and C that other people are doing. Let's focus on the A's that we have and make those A pluses and we'll see the performance come from there. We'll compete in the free market system. I mean, are we saying God's ways are inferior to man's ways? I don't think so. But let's act as if we believe that and trust that as we go forward in our workplace. So working as yoked with Christ and being bold to do the right thing over a period of time. So let's carry on. Our work should be centered on service to others. We turn the page. At last, we turn the page. Our work should be centered on service to others. Again, this to me is another place where Christians are in competitive advantage. I think a lot in the business world about competition, right? I mean, we can't just be sort of airy-fairy and be nice and hope that things work out. We actually have to think systematically about how we can win, how we can do better products, how we can create environments that people want to work. you know, one of the things that I think is most important is in serving others. A core value of the Christian life is the other-centric life, right? So Philippians 2, 3, and 4, right? Do nothing out of vain conceit or selfish ambition, but in all things consider others more important than ourselves, right? I mean, it's the great passage on humility and other people, and it goes on, obviously, to talk about the example of Jesus, which we're supposed to follow. That is a core aspect of the Christian life, is other-centricism. How does other-centricism work in a competitive workplace? Well, I mean, any place you go that's worth its salt is focusing on the client. What is that but other-centricism? It's not what we want to do as an organization, it's what does my client need? The first place I go is I talk to my client. How can I help you? What else do you have to do? What service can I provide? What are you not receiving right now? What frustrates you? What can I do to help you in your work? That's other-centricism. It's the same within our organizations. When we've got work groups, how can I help you? As an executive, one of the things I need to do is I need to set a culture which allows people to thrive. But then essentially, I need to make sure that I'm getting stuff out of the way so that people can do their work. That's other-centricism. How do I think about giving you a clear runway so that the task I've given you can actually be done? How do I think about setting up an organization in such a way there are no politics? I mean, some of you may work in organizations with politics. I mean, how debilitating is politics, right? I mean, just think of an organization in which 100% of the people are focusing on solving clients' problems versus an organization in which 50% of the people are trying to get ahead of the other 50%. It doesn't take a lot of time, because an organization is nothing more than thousands of decisions being made every day. And if you have all your people making decisions in alignment with where you're trying to get to and for your customer, you have a completely different organization than one where everybody's trying to get ahead of each other. And it's just debilitating. It leads to lack of trust. It leads to righteousness and justice going down the tubes. So this whole issue, I think, of being centered in service to others is a mark of the Christian life. And it's an understanding of our position relative to God and what we're doing. We're here to move creation forward. We're here to be an act of service. We're not here. I mean, there are seven times ambition is talked about in the New Testament. It uses two different Greek words. One is always translated as selfish ambition, five times, always bad. Like I just quoted in Philippians, do nothing out of vain conceit or selfish ambition, always bad. The other two times, a different word, forgive me, I can't remember the word, but it's always translated as goal or, you know, eternal ambition. So Paul has an ambition to preach the word over the whole world. That's the word ambition there. We need to have those ambitions, not selfish ambitions. We need to have kingdom ambitions and growth ambitions. And those things are other-centric in the way they go forward. So... And I want to introduce at this point a word that I think is valuable, because I think it helps us think about how we do this in the workplace. The word is oikonomai. It's a Greek word. It's made of two pieces. Oikos, which Todd will be able to tell you, means home, and nomos, which means law. So oikonomai is the person who is basically the person who gives the law at home, the lawgiver at home. It appears in the New Testament 10 times. And I think it's a very interesting word for us to think about, because I think it gets the nature of what I'm trying to talk about in this transition from work into being more entrusted one by God in the marketplace. And so in a couple of places, in Luke, for example, it's translated just as master. It's translated typically as master or steward. Right? I mean, you understand that, right? If it's the lawgiver in the house, to have it be called master, that's a fairly straightforward translation. I mean, some interesting places that it's translated. So, for example, in Luke, the story of the shrewd manager, which one of these days I'd love to hear Todd preach on.
I have.
It's one of the things I really want to go back and hear the take. Because I always struggle with that, right? I mean, here's the guy who cuts all these deals to cut his master out, and what does Jesus do? He commends him for being shrewd. So, anyway. But anyway, that master or steward is the word for that shrewd manager, right? Manager or steward. It's the shrewd manager in Luke. That's oikonomai. In Luke, it's described as master, so same kind of thing. But here it becomes more interesting when you hear some other areas, because it becomes kind of more elevated. So in Romans 10:23, it's described as the city treasurer is the oikonomos. And that's how you're seeing an elevation now in responsibility, the person who's the treasurer of the city. In 1 Corinthians 4, well, I'll go over to Titus 1, it's the overseer of God's household. It's one of the characteristics of an elder, oikonomos. It's the overseer there is the translation of oikonomos. So now God is basically saying, no, it's not just a manager, it's actually the overseer or the elder of my church. So you see he's now elevating that role and giving more responsibility. You go over to 1 Corinthians 4 in 1 and 2, it's translated as the stewards, get back to that word stewards, but the stewards of the mysteries of God. The stewards of the mysteries of God. I mean, all of a sudden, this is oikonomos is something much more significant in God's vision here. Galatians 4:2, another step up, the guardian of a son by a father. That's oikonomos. So we're not talking about manager any longer. I mean, if I gave Ian Christopher when he was 3 years old, I wouldn't want him to manage Christopher. Like, make sure he got fed and put to bed on time and, you know, that's it. You know, when he is the guardian, he is responsible for building into that young man everything as a father would do. It's a complete substitute of God to do the things that God would do in that circumstance. And it's a very precious thing that God has given him, his son, or in this case, the guardian. And then finally, 1 Peter 4:10, the faithful steward of God's grace. I mean, I think it's something we'd all want to be found accountable for or held in high regard for, is the faithful steward of God's grace. So what I want you to see is this is a word, it's the same word. At one end, it's kind of manager or steward. In other words, just look after what's going on. But at the other end, it's sort of God's substitute to look after things that are of great concern to God. His church, his son, not Jesus, I mean, but a son in this particular case. The mysteries, his mysteries, and the steward of his grace. So it's very much more than, yes, you can translate it as manager or steward at one end, but it's very much more than that. It's the responsibility that God has imparted towards us. And so when we go back to that first narrative we talked about of what God is doing and how he's engaging us in this process of creation that he's working through and the gifting that we've got to be able to do this fantastic calling. I think we also see that God is calling us to do it in a very special way as his, and I don't even have a word for it. You could use ambassador, maybe. You could use trustee. But it's something that God has entrusted to us and said, be me in this place. Be me in this place. So when you go to work on Monday, what does it look like to be God in that place? Now, I don't mean be God like lording it over everybody. But being in the way he would do it. This is the piece of God's creation that he's given you. This is for you to influence. How are you going to influence it? How are you going to think about bringing creativity to bear to do better products and services? How are you going to bring your understanding of people to bear so that you can create work groups, you can create harmony and a healthy environment and a healthy culture so that people can thrive? How are you going to think about righteousness and justice, doing the right things even if it costs you in the short term? How are you going to think about being other-centric and in service to other people, whether it be customers or your people in your organization? And what kind of difference is it going to make? You know, I tell this story about Chris's sister, Victoria. She went to she's an ophthalmic technician, and she went to an organization in Hartford when she moved there. And it was a large eye doctor's office. And after about 3 weeks, she called me up and said, Dad, I can't take it any longer. I'm going to have to quit. So I said, why are you going to have to quit? She said, oh, it's a terrible environment. Everybody's after each other. You know, they're rude to each other. The doctors don't care. Everybody gets treated like dirt. And someone this morning, it was the final straw, they said, you're too nice. You're not going to last here. So I'm going to quit. I said, okay. So I said, well, let's think about this for a minute. She said, Dad, I don't want to hear any theology of work stuff. So, Chris will tell you, we talk about the theology of work a lot at our house. So. He's scarred. So I said, well, let me just think a minute. I said, if you describe yourself, you know, the gifting that God has given you, I mean, how would you describe yourself? And she said, well, I'm an encourager. I said, well, let me just think a minute. Does it surprise us that God has put an encourager in a place that needs encouragement? She said, I hate it when you do it. So, all right, I'll carry on. A year and a half later, Andrew, her husband, is at a Christmas dinner. Lots of things have happened in this place. And this head doctor comes up to Andrew and said, your wife has changed this entire organization. Now, it's not her. It's the Holy Spirit working through her. But she wanted to quit. I was wide. No, I'm... But into the darkest place, right? Even a little light will make a big difference. And so, where's the place that God has put you? Some of you are probably sitting there going, I hate my work. Some of you are probably thinking, I'm looking for a new job. I got to get out of here. And maybe that's what God's calling you to do. But for maybe some of you, it's exactly where God has you. Until he moves you on, that's where you are. And that's the part of God's creation that he's given you to be his oikonomos, to understand who he is and what he do and how he live it, so that you begin to bring some of Christ's redemption. You know, creation is groaning. So you can bring part of Christ's redemption to that place that you work. I don't know what that looks like for all of you. I don't know what that means. I can't. I struggle with just doing it for myself. But it's a totally different way of thinking about work. It's not work any longer. It's partnering with God. It's doing the things he wants you to do. It's making changes. It's bringing love and faithfulness and righteousness and justice back into the workplace. There's nothing I like more than when people just say, I really love working here. You know, when you've got young people who really love working here because of how you organize things and because of what God has done in and midst, there's no better feeling. You know, I grew Thompson for 15 plus years. We went from $300,000 to $3.5 billion of revenue. I can't remember any of them. I remember those numbers. But I can't remember any other numbers. I can't even remember the acquisitions I made. I made over 100 acquisitions. I can't remember them. I mean, a couple I can, but I remember the people. And still today, we all talk together. We all knew we had something very special. And we enjoyed it for that period of time. And that, to me, was the greatest reward. Building into people. And by the way, I never flaunted my faith. Everybody knew where I came from. But very regularly, at 6:30 in the evening, I'd hear, knock on my door. People would walk in, all different levels in the organization. Can I talk? And I knew it wasn't about business. It was always about faith. And we led a lot of people to Christ. Work is not about evangelism. Work is about work. But evangelism will happen very faithfully because it's a place where people are under a lot of stress. And you're with them a long period of time. And you can build relationships and the right to talk to people about why you're different. But you've got to be different. If you look like everybody else, they're not going to come to you. That's the word oikonomos, and I really commend it to you. Number 7, a rhythm of work and rest. Thankfully, God built in a rhythm of work and rest to our lives, right? God created for 6 days, and he rested on the 7th. Now, he didn't rest because he was tired. He rested because he was done and he wanted to focus on what he'd done and his creation. And I think for us, he does bring us rest, which is physical rest. But I think he also wants to bring resting in him. And I think he wants to bring us a time where we can actually just get out of the kind of craziness of the week and pull back a little bit and just recenter ourselves on knowing who he is and focusing on him. So I'm not a... some people are, and I admire this. I'm not a... how would I describe it? A fanatical Sabbath maintainer. I mean, I will do things on Sunday afternoon, but Sunday for us typically is church in the morning. It's lunch at China Sky. Always is. we discussed the sermon. You might like to know. And then in the afternoon, we just typically hang out as a family. And that's just a glorious Sunday for me. And it's a time of rest. It's a time of being with my family. It's what God wants us to do. And so we focus on him, and I focus on my family. Because that's the order of things. Family, God, family, work. And Sunday's that opportunity to just step back. Now, for some people, it can't be Sunday. But it'll be another day. And you just need to find time. You know, people talk a lot about the balance of work, you know, work-life balance. I think that's a complete misnomer. It's a complete waste of time to think about that. Everybody's seeking for work-life balance and nobody gets it. And I think there's a reason for that, which is balance implies some form of equilibrium can be reached. Life never provides an equilibrium. It's always talking about living under tension. And it's how you manage the tension. So I always give this example of life is kind of like this plastic or rubber sheet that has a number of handles around it. And different parts of your life are grabbing hold of the different handles and they're pulling. And sometimes one thing pulls very hard. All of a sudden you might get an illness in the family or a big work issue happens or something. And all of a sudden that gets pulled. And what you have to recognize is that it distorts the rubber and it takes away from all the other handles. Right? Puts them all under pressure. But you have to recognize that when one thing is pulling hard, everything else is giving up some. My life in the old days was work was pulling. And I didn't realize how much it was giving up and all the other things in my life that I needed to know about, whether it be family, friends, God. Now, Ecclesiastes tells us there's a season for everything. And we go through seasons. When that piece of rubber can be stretched out of shape, but we have to recognize if we do it over a long enough period of time that something else is dying ultimately because the other things that are pulling will gradually kind of give up. And all of a sudden you live a distorted kind of life. So you have to recognize you got to pull, but at some point you've got to get back under control and then give back to the other things. And what are those other things? Because some things are being taken away from. Some things are being stolen from, if you will. How do I replenish those things? For a married couple, I think it's very important to have those kinds of discussions. Hon, it looks like for the next 3 months, I'm just under the cosh. And this is what it's going to be, and I'm going to have to work late, and I'm going to have to travel, and, you know, I mean, this is where we are, this is what we're trying to do. You know, if your wife or husband has an understanding of that, you get through it together. In fact, you're partner together, you help each other rather than oppose each other. But, you know, as I said to somebody, you know, I lied to my wife 40 times over 10 years. Because I said every quarter is going to be better next quarter. And I really believe that. Because when I looked at my calendar, this quarter was like black with entries. And I'd go forward 3 months and I'd see kind of white space. That was going to be better. Of course, when you get there, that's filled in. And then the next quarter looks good. And so, you know, I mean, I lied. I believed it to be true. But my work was pulling all the time. And Gail got to a place where ultimately she just said, I can't compete against that. You know, and that was very hard for us. So you have got to build a rhythm of work and rest. You've also got to recognize that you live a life under tension. And you just have to be, it's okay. We all live a life under tension. That's not a problem. What's a problem is if you don't recognize that and you give one thing or another thing dominance for a long period of time over everything else, you've got to recognize that all the other things are giving away. And we have to have time for everything. So, you know, you might want to today do a little bit of self-reflection in terms of what are the things that I hold dear, what are holding the handles around my rubber sheet, and where do I feel those tensions, and have I, you know, how do I have to think about maybe changing the balance a little bit. And if you want to be so bold, maybe married couples should talk to each other about that. You might get a very different, it's a very dangerous thing to do, guys, because you'll hear the truth. And it's not always what you want to hear, but you know what? It doesn't matter what you want to hear, it's what's true that's important. And then you can deal with it. So work-life balance, very, very important. Not work-life balance. Work and rest, rhythm, important. Tension is the way we live our lives. We have to deal with that. And those are kind of some of the how things I want to talk about. Then there's a couple of things I want to say in terms of some additional ideas. Number 8 is very, because I want to get some questions. Number 8 is very straightforward, which basically says, look, as a result of work, you are going to end up with things. We happen to be very fortunate. We live in one of the most prosperous countries in the world. If you hold a half-decent job, I know the costs are high, but on average, we end up in nice homes. We have cars. Sometimes we have two cars. We go on vacations. Life is pretty good for us, and in some cases, we are able to save and do a whole bunch of things. One of the things that I think is important from a work point of view is that as a result of working, we end up with things, whatever that might be. And we have to think very specifically about how we use the resources that God has given us through the work process that we've been involved in. Now, I spent a lot of time with people talking about tithing. You always get into the interesting question, is it pre-tax or after-tax, the 10%? To which I say, if that's the discussion, we're in a completely wrong place, right? I mean, God is not, a 1040 form here. I actually, and we can have a discussion about this later, but I actually don't believe that tithing is a New Testament. I think the tithing is gone. I think it was Old Testament. And I think about it very differently. I think everything is God's. That's where I start. It's not 10% is God's. Everything is God's. And when you start with that thought, then the question is, okay, God, how do you want to allocate that which you've given me, which is yours? Because it's your responsibility, God, to help me think that through. And I find that does a couple of things. Number one is it helps me with generosity, because it's not my money, and it's easy to give somebody else's money away, right? But I think the second thing it does, I think it restrains me in terms of buying things that I could otherwise buy, and it leads me to a more, temperate lifestyle. Now, I have to say, you stand up here in front of a guy who owns three homes and, three cars and, the big houses. And so God has been very, very gracious to me. But for people to do the same thing as I do, I'm significantly less, less spent than other people. We work very hard on giving. We give, very strongly. And to us, that's the joy. And that's the responsibility. And so I really encourage you to be givers. I really encourage you to think about this is God's money and how would he, just the simple question, how would he have us allocate our resources? Now, God is not a cosmic killjoy. He's not gonna say, okay, you've got to go live in a, Walden Pond and put up another lean-to next to Thoreau's home and hut and, give everything up. That's not who he is. But we tend to at times chase things at the margin that we shouldn't be chasing. And I think by having that attitude that this is God's, he releases you to do things. And if you're going to make major purchases, you've got to put it in front of him. And you've got to have his approval. Now, by the way, one of the things I would say when you're looking for God's approval, don't say, God, I'm going to pray for the next couple of days, and this is what I, this is what I think you want me to do, and let's just do it. Because at the end of 2 days, what will have happened is you won't have heard from God necessarily. You go, oh yeah, I'm going to do it. Everything's fine. And you go ahead. What I'd recommend in that decision making is that you basically say to God, okay, God, I'm going to pray for this and maybe fast for this over the next 48 to 72 hours. I think this is what you want me to do. If this is not what you want me to do, would you please have something happen in the next 48 to 72 hours that makes it very clear this is not what you want me to do? In other words, if all we're trying to do is confirm what we already want to do, we're going to fool ourselves. But if we invite God to intersect our life miraculously and just do something that makes it clear that you should not be doing this, and if that's really the attitude of your heart, then you wait and see. And if he does something, thank God. He stopped you from doing something he doesn't want you to do. If you've not heard anything from him, it's not a difficult decision. Did he intervene or didn't he? It's not I'm trying to figure out what I think. It's just did he or didn't he? If he hasn't intervened and you gave him the right and that was the desire of your heart to know God's leading, if he hasn't intervened, then you have his blessing. And you don't have to worry about it. It's a go. So I really encourage you to think those kinds of things through in terms of how you use your wealth and how you spend it. The Bible tells us to look after the poor. It also tells us we'll always have the poor. But that doesn't take the responsibility away. Matthew 25, again, the least of these. And, you know, Isaiah 58:10, because I think when you talk about your resources, you can't just think, we always think about money, but I mean, people talk about time, treasure, and talent. Isaiah 58:10 is that wonderful passage of supporting the undertrodden. And 58:10 talks about spending ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things we often do is we write a check, and it's kind of like, okay, here's a check, and I don't have to think about it any longer. One of the things I do encourage you to do on a giving front is to give to fewer places more rather than more places less. And those places that you give to become engaged in your own right, whether it be volunteering or this, that, and the other, because you need to spend yourself. That's what God calls us to in Isaiah 58, spend ourselves as well as our resources. So it's not just checkbook, but it's our own time and it's our own talent. And I think amazing things happen. God's work, number 9, multiplies through relationships through the local church. You know, I can't stress this strongly enough. We need to live the Christian life in community. One of the things I see and I think is the major trick of the enemy in the workplace is isolation. We're finding all the time people working 2 doors down from somebody else who's a Christian feeling very isolated but not knowing that person's a Christian. What we're doing in New York right now is we're trying to gather groups of people together in the big brokerage houses and the big investment management firms and getting the Christians just to meet each other and gather together and get to know who's there. Because isolation is really very, very tough. So, you know, make it known that you're a Christian and look for other people. Pull community up. You know, even if they're completely different organization with parts of the organization, try and find a time where you can have a brown bag lunch and maybe you just talk and say hello and pray for 5 minutes. But just begin to know each other in community. It's so very, very important. And the most important community we can have is the local church. And make sure that you're in groups. Make sure that you have people. In the workplace, we call it a personal board of directors. A group of 2 or 3 or 4 people who know you very well, who can speak into your life. I've had a personal board of directors now for, I don't know, 20-something years, more than. Now, we don't convene like a board meeting. But it's Ian and Scott and Stan. Some of you don't know who these guys are, but you'll actually see them back on the 25th anniversary because they were guys who were the early elders of the church. And we've been in very close formation over many years. And these guys know me probably better than I know me. And they're able to speak into my life when they need to speak into my life, as I told you Ian had done earlier, which is an incredibly brave thing to do, for which I'm forever grateful. And some of the things there. And I just want to conclude by saying this. This is kind of like a little bit like Ecclesiastes when in the end, right, when you've had all these very complex chapters, it's sort of in the end, here's the end of the matter, right? Fear God. That's a good place to stop. But I would say in the workplace, this is the place to stop, which is work is a gift from God. You know? Work is a gift from God. It's very interesting. In Ecclesiastes 5:19, it talks about work and the ability to enjoy it. Wealth and the ability to enjoy it is all a gift from God. Again, getting back to my theme, it's nothing to do with us. It's all a gift from God. Work is a gift from God. Do we think about work as a gift from God? Well, if we don't have the right attitude towards it, it's very hard to think about it as a gift because I'm off to work again and it's toil and it's difficult and all those kinds of things. But if we change our attitude and we see what God's inviting us into, I think we can see this as a gift. It's interesting, on my Bible, if you open it up, Ecclesiastes 4 is on the left side, Ecclesiastes 5 is on the right. So I'm looking at, you know, work as a gift of God at 5:19. If I go over to 4:4, Ecclesiastes 4:4, what I read is, and I saw that all labor and all achievements stem from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless. So on the one hand, I've got all labor and all achievement. Not some, I mean all, it's pretty condemning, stems from man's envy of his neighbor. This is meaningless. And on the other side, the work is a gift of God, the ability to enjoy it is a gift of God. Now, there's an inherent tension in those two things. There's an inherent tension all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. But you have to put those things together. Work can either be looked at as a striving and an achievement oriented thing based on wrong motivations, one's envy of one's neighbor, or one can accept it as a gift of God. And how you think about it drives your entire life and how much meaning you get out of those things. Going back to that continuum we saw at the beginning of my conversation this morning, the continuum of idolatrousness versus utilitarianism. And I refer you back to where we started with Isaiah 65. You know, it talks about working in the new kingdom, in the new heaven. And it talks about work will not be in vain. There will be a time where work, which is stained by sin, will no longer be stained by sin. And I'm looking forward to that day. And I look forward to working. And I look forward to working in a way that matches and maximizes the gifting that God has given me, in a way that glorifies Him, in harmony, and through redemption in a redeemed world. And that's our future. And I find that a glorious future. But we live in a time that the theologians would call you as a period of initiated eschatology. What that means is Jesus has won, but He's not yet come back again. And we live in this interregnum period. And our responsibility in this interregnum period is to be oikonomon to God, His trustee, His ambassador, His representative, right where we live and right where we work. And that's a calling. That's a very high calling. And it will change your life. So thank you for spending time with me this morning. I think maybe let's throw it open to a whole bunch of questions and we'll go from there. David.
One formulation I've always found helpful, it's very simple, but to me it brings all these things together, is that I'm performing in the parties of one. Mm-hmm. I think about that all the time in the workplace. And,
yep.
You know, and people put bracelets together, what did Jesus do? It's the same concept.
Yeah. Well, I think, and I'm guilty of this, and I think probably most of us are, you know, is we forget that, I mean, I made the point earlier, I forget that God is watching, right? He's there all the time. In fact, it's interesting, if you go to 2:19, Genesis 2:19, you know, we talked about 2:5, we talked about 2:15. If we go to 2:19, what you see is God watching as Adam names the animals. Right? He's given him the right to name the animals. It's part of the creative process. And God is watching. And I can only imagine that God is really enjoying it. He called it what? Oh, okay. You know. Now, on the other hand, you look at what God created, I'm sure Adam was going, what the heck is this, right? How do I call that something? So, but I think we need to think of the same thing. You know, God has called us to name the animals, whatever it is that we have now been called to by God. And God is watching, and the question is simply, is He pleased? Is He pleased? We can't escape that.
I think these concepts, too, apply to us as we live in our homes.
Oh, yeah.
And we lost Barbara Bush this week, and it was pretty cool seeing her life. She was a faithful woman. She just encouraged hard work and integrity in her family, and how would she have known the outcome, being married to the president, having a son of the president, another one of the governor. And she found time, you know, in that tension to do things for others in terms of literacy, cancer.
Yep.
Christian households are also foundational for God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. So thanks.
Yeah, she was a great lady. I was reading her, I was rereading her commencement address at Wellesley in 1999, which if you haven't read it, it was a time of great tension. And the feminists at Wellesley were really up in arms about Barbara Bush, who was this traditional, you know, kind of undertrodden woman coming, and she gave, and they wanted another speaker, an African-American poetess, but she, for some reason, she didn't come. And so Barbara Bush spoke and just wowed them with just a general, her personhood. And one of her lines that just got them eating out of her hand, she said, you know, maybe in this room today, there is somebody else who will do what I have done, or something like this, who will be a spouse of a president. And of course, there were gasps, right? Because this is we're Wellesley grads. We're not going to be the spouse of a president. And then she paused, and then she said, and I hope he does it well. And, which implies the president would be a woman. And everybody just, you know, went crazy, right? So she had such a generous spirit about it. But I think a more general point that you raised, you know, when I talk about work, I'm not just talking about the workplace, you know, where we get paid. I'm talking everything we do to apply the gifts and skills we've got into the place that God has brought us. The home is key. The community, schools. You know, our kids are working. I mean, their work at that time, you've got to learn. That's their workplace. And so I think we, you know, everything I've said applies to all of these places equally. Now, we tend to focus on the paid workplace, but, you know, let's not minimize the fact that, you know, some, if not the most important work that gets done is in the home, bringing children up, because that's the future. And that's been so undermined by our current culture, which is really, well, it's not surprising, right? Because it's destroying the family, which is God's building block, and leads to all these other kinds of issues. So, yeah, thanks for that reminder. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you can unpack a little bit more the concept of the work-life balance. You were talking about how there's going to be a natural tension, and there'll always be kind of pulling from one direction to the other. But I guess I try to think about it as the concept of being, you know, what is your priority, and kind of comparing it to your responsibilities as well. So when you talk about a spouse being at the home or somebody working, how does that kind of relate? Because if I stay at work that extra hour and complete the project that I want to complete that day, or take on a new task, that has another effect on the responsibility that I have to be home with my wife and to support her. So, like you said, there will always be that tension, but I guess I struggle with trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. And you know, you might say a balance is impossible, so it's kind of do the best you can, but how can you be winning at home and winning at work and covering those responsibilities in a holistic way?
Well, you use the word priority. It's interesting, just for historical understanding, that the word priority was never a plural word until the 20th century. So we made it priorities because we wanted more than one. But actually, the word priority in its origin was a singular word.
Sure.
You can only have
one.
You can only have one. What's your priority in your life? And I think that's kind of instructive, that we've got to have a pole. We've got to have that plumb line. We've got to have a pole position somewhere, which is, this is our priority. And then everything else works around that. And so, you know, the issue of how do you balance these things? You know, I think in a marriage in particular, you know, if you're single, you can have your discussion with yourself in the morning in the mirror. But I think one of the things that's very important in a married couple, you know, don't forget we're one. And, you know, one of my mistakes early on in marriage is we were one, but I didn't operate that way. So I would say, well, I consulted my wife, but my consultation was more like, hey, I'm going to do this. Is that okay with you? That's not consultation, right? And I think, you know, we have to think about talking together as one, making a decision about the priority for our family. And I think you have to understand what those trade-offs are and what those tensions are and what the timing of those things are. And I think the most important thing is a married couple can get through just about everything if they're on the same page. Mm-hmm. So you got to get on the same page. And I really need to get on the same page, not just have your wife or your husband sort of say begrudgingly, okay, but really feel that this is what God's calling you to. So you get back to this issue of calling. So for example, for Gail now, so, you know, if I used to fly out on a Sunday night or a Monday morning on Thompson business, she really hated that. But I leave every morning early to get on the train to go down to New York right now. She encouraged, she's trying to get me out of the house, but no, she encourages that because she sees that, you know, as a couple, we figured out what it is that God's calling us to do together and separately. But separately is still as an entity. And when you do that, it's just so much simpler. When you're on the same side, life, as you know, is so much easier. So I encourage a very frank, open conversation. What that might mean is it might mean your spouse might push back and say, you know, I think you're spending too much time at work. And this is really causing issues with our kids, it's causing issues here. And, you know, you've got to really think about that. So what does that then mean? So does that mean then you have to take on less projects? Does that mean you have to get promoted less quickly? I mean, what does that mean? You have to do cases that have less travel? Do you have to change your job? I mean, you know, what are all those things? But ultimately, here's the point. I want to express this as clearly as I can. God is in charge of your life. And if he is talking to you through your spouse, and I'm not saying this is your case, I'm looking at you, but I'm not accusing you of this for anybody. If God is using your spouse to tell you that what you're doing right now, or a friend to tell you what you're doing right now is not what you should be doing, you should want that feedback. And then you think about what it is that God actually really wants you to do and how you should do it. And ultimately, a belief and a trust in God that he's going to take you to the place through this process, which is the best possible place for you. So ultimately, it comes down to the same thing all the time. Do I trust God? It always keeps coming back to that question. Do I trust God? And am I prepared just to let go? Or am I going to keep hanging on because I think I got a better idea? And it's one of those things that it's not an easy thing to do. It's a thing that you practice, and it's a thing you experience time and time again. And for some that are hard, for whom it's a hard learning, like me, it has to be a really a 2x4 across the head several times to kind of get the message. And there's a collateral damage to that, and you have to recognize there's collateral damage to that as well. God forgives, but there's still the results of the things that linger. I mean, look at David. David was fully forgiven by God, but look at the impact on his family, right? There are consequences, so, and they linger. So it's just being attentive to God. It's listening to him through your spouse, through your work, through friends, through the Spirit talking to you, through reading scripture. It's just a willingness to follow God into wherever he will lead and give up selfish ambition, but be ambitious for the kingdom. And wherever God sends you, that's where you can be ambitious for the kingdom. That may or may not be the answer that you were asking for. I may not have answered the question, but that led me to that. Yeah, Rob, yes.
I have three again.
Gosh.
the first goes back to the topic of ethics.
Of ethics?
Ethics. Do you have advice for those of us that are struggling to process what has come out over the last few weeks from the Willow Creek Association? And if you prefer not to bring it up, that's
I actually don't know what it is, so.
Good. The second is, do you have a Peter Drucker title?
Yes. The essential Drucker. No. The essential executive. The essential executive.
The essential executive.
I think that's what it is, by Peter Drucker. And I recommend the middle segment on the individual. That's like page, I don't know, 130 to 200 and something. Let me just make sure I've got the right phraseology. I think he's very good on this. I read the book all the time and I can't remember the title. Isn't that amazing? That speaks to where I am in my chronology here. Maybe I was right. Maybe it's the essential Drucker. That's what I thought initially. No. Back again. The Effective Executive by Drucker.
And the third is, can you spell, is it
Oikonomon? Oikonomon. O-I-K-O-N-O-M-O-N. M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
One more time.
Okay, on the board. I'm not sure that my handwriting is any better. Oikonomon. So oikos, meaning house or home.
And nomos meaning law, and this is the person who does it. So the lawgiver or the
leader of the household or the master or the steward or as we've seen. But do a word search on that and really look through those passages. They're really, it's a really a fascinating word study. Yeah, Ian.
Yeah, so when I think about a lot is like I hear biblical verses like a companion of fools suffers harm, and you hear about the concept of kind of being part of the world but separated. And so what I struggle with is you hear about great characters like Daniel and Joseph that live like really these awesome and thrive in these very like bad environments, and they, they're great models for us today. But I think about how they ended up there was that they just they got forced there.
Right.
And make the choice, like, I am going to choose to go into that type of environment. And that's what I struggle with. Like, how much of it is really God's calling versus how much of it is us just bringing the foolishness upon ourselves and the suffering upon ourselves.
Yeah, and look, I think the great thing about it, Daniel, for example, you know, I think the brilliance of Daniel and why he did so well is he knew the things of the world because he was taught them, and he knew the things of God. And I think that's a model for all of us to think about. And I'll answer your question in a minute, but that's just an aside. I think we're called on to be the people who understand the things of God, but also are trained in the things of the world. And we bring those two things together, and we become more effective as a result. I come back to my competitive advantage thought. To me, that's the competitive advantage Daniel had. That's the competitive advantage Joseph had. That's the competitive advantage we as Christians can have in today's world. But, you know, you're right. I mean, Daniel had no, I mean, he had some choices in terms of what he did, in terms of eating the vegetables and all those kinds of things. But you're right. I mean, he was a captive, and he was taken there and this, that, and the other. But what he then decided to do was the best he could with where he was. You know, I would say this, that, you know, you can kind of get yourself into analysis paralysis if you're not careful. You know, why am I here? What's my calling? I would just start from the place that this is where God brought me. However you got here, this is it. So let me start with that. And then let me start to work on why I'm here and this, that, and the other. Then over time, you know, you can begin to think about, is God calling me to something different? If there are choices within work, maybe there are things that I'm finding that I'm better at than other things that match my calling. So as I talk to my boss about, you know, what I want to see for my development, maybe he can lead me more to this side than that side in the future. So you can begin to shape a direction in line with what you're talking about. Or you can feel a calling from God just to say, it's time to go. And by the way, that can happen like you get fired, like I